Yeah, we are in week 3 of Guardrails, and in this series, we've been kind of comparing our lives to the open road, and what we've been saying is on the open road, we are all grateful that someone took some time to think about having some guardrails in place so that when we're driving down the road, when we hit a bridge, when we're driving through the mountains, when we're driving around some curves, when we're driving in busy, heavy traffic on the interstate, that we have something that comes between us and danger. And the definition that we've talked about for the guardrails on the open road is simply this. It's a system designed to keep vehicles from straying into dangerous or off-limits areas. In other words, when on the road, we know that there are some areas that there's danger just on the other side of a guardrail, whether it be down a mountainside, our car ending up in a river. There's all kinds of areas where we go, I'm really glad that someone took the time to think and put a guardrail here so that I ding my car, but I don't end up in a river. So that I ding my car, but I don't end up in a ditch. So that I ding my car, but I don't fall down a mountainside to my impending fiery death. We're all grateful that someone put those guardrails in place on the road. And what we've been saying, the reason we've used this analogy is we believe that in our personal lives, we need guardrails just as much as we do on the open road. We think it's just as important to have some guardrails in our lives because there are some areas of danger in our personal lives where on the other side of what we are calling our guardrails, there is potential for danger. In all of these areas that we've been talking about, there's potentially great good, but there's also potential for great danger. And so the definition that we've used here for this series when it comes to our personal lives, when we need guardrails, is that a guardrail is a personal standard of behavior that becomes a matter of conscience. It's personal because my guardrails are going to be different than your guardrails, and your guardrails are going to be different than mine. Where each of us need them will be different from each other. So it's a personal standard of behavior because we want to make the decision now, not when things get emotional. We want to make the decision today, not tomorrow, when something is emotionally appealing and drawing us towards somewhere where there is danger. So it's a personal standard of behavior that this is what I will do and this is what I won't do. This is how far I will go and this is how far I will not go. It's a personal standard of behavior that becomes a matter of conscience. Would you guys say conscience? Yeah, it becomes a matter of conscience because the idea here is that we don't want to wait till we're experiencing the consequences of danger for our conscience to light up. In other words, we don't want to be falling down a cliff and go, oh no. We actually want our conscience to go, oh no, when we feel ourselves drifting in the direction of danger. So well before we fall over the edge, if we start drifting or moving towards something that's dangerous, we want our conscience to actually go ding, 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 pay attention, pay attention, pay attention. So again, so we ding our conscience, but we don't lose or wreck our lives. So we've been talking about a few areas. The first week, we actually addressed the area of alcohol a little bit because we thought, what better to make people uncomfortable than to talk about alcohol and our personal use of alcohol? We thought that was a great way to start. Then last week, we talked about our friendships and our influential relationships because what you know and I know is that our friendships determine the direction and the quality of our lives, that whoever we give access and influence in our lives, we're giving them a hand on the wheel and we're giving them a foot on the gas pedal. And so we want to make sure we're paying attention and we're very careful about who has influence, who's a voice that actually gets to speak in our lives. And so we talked about friendships. We gave some guardrails, some things to pay attention so that we protect ourselves from the wrong people and the wrong voices and the wrong influences, and so that we direct ourselves and keep the right people and the right voices and the right influences close to us. So that's where we have been, in case you've missed, in case you don't get a chance to go back and listen to the podcast. That's where we have been. And today, I want to move into a direction, and I want to move into a new area that we're going to talk about today. And I just want to let you know up front, I feel like this area is the area that if all of us got this right, whether you're a Christian or not, if all of us started to get this area right, it would actually be the area that changes our world the most, okay? So I know that could sound like it's an oversell. I promise that's not an oversell. I really do believe if every person in the world or even every person in our city paid attention to guardrails or established some guardrails in this specific area, it actually could change our city, maybe could change our state, maybe could change our country, maybe could even change the world if everyone in the world actually paid attention to guardrails in this area. And so today, the area that we're going to talk about today is sex and sexuality. You're thinking, great. What a great day to come to church. We're going to have the sex talk. Yeah, it's like if you grew up in church and you grew up having like a youth pastor and you ever had the sex talk, you know, which apparently in youth group happens like once every month. So like if you're like, oh good, I thought we were done with that when we left youth group, we're having it today. And so I just wanted to let you know, today we're going to talk about sex. You know, 2 weeks ago we talked about alcohol. It's like, hey, talked about alcohol week one, sex week three. Man, it's a bold strategy, Cotton. Let's see if it pays off for him. You know, like, We're going to talk about sex. And here's the reason, here's the thing. Today, I want to let you know first and foremost, this is not a guilt talk about anyone's past. So if you're thinking, oh man, every time someone talks about sex in church, I just feel so guilty about my past, That is not what I hope you experience today. Today is not about making anyone feel guilty about anything that has happened in the past. What today is about is making sure we know how to step carefully and take steps properly so that we don't end up with regret in the future. Does that make sense? I want to make sure that we experience everything that God has for us that's healthy when it comes to sex, and I want to make sure that we carry none of the regret and none of the shame forward from this point forward. So here's the thing that I know and that you know. When it comes to sex, there's incredible potential for good. I thought we might get some amens there. I just want to let you, like, when it comes to church, we don't believe sex is bad. We don't believe sex is dirty. We believe sex was actually something that God created, which is a little bit weird to think about, right? Like that, like what we experience when it comes to sex is actually something that God planned. Like that, like God was trying to figure out, like let's. So we got these people that we've created, and they're going to need to reproduce. How should we do that? And God was like, I've got it. Like here's what we'll do. And he got the angels around. He's like, guys, check this out. And the angel's like, man, I wish I could do that. And he's like, yeah, I know, right? So God created sex to be good. God created sex to be enjoyed. God created sex to be something that was a very good thing. I mean, in our church, we have so many children running around. We got a whole bunch of babies that they're not running yet. They're being carried around. And I love, we have so many babies and so many beautiful kids running around our church. And I just want to let you know, every one of those children is the result of sex. Right? Which is going to make some of you look at the kids in the church a little bit different. Like when you see them with your parents, like, oh, now I can't not think of that. You know, like, so like it was, it's a good thing. Children are the result of sex. Like that. It's a good thing. My daughter, the most precious baby in the world. She's got pigtails today. She's got this cute little dress on. She's the result. I'm not going to finish it. Anyway, so But sex is meant to be a good thing. If you've experienced a good, healthy sexual relationship as a married couple and seen the intimacy that grows there, like it's meant to be a beautiful thing. So there's incredible potential for good when it comes to sex. But the reason I think we need to talk about guardrails when it comes to sex is I know something that you know, and as I say it, none of us are going to be really surprised by this, but the biggest reason we need guardrails when it comes to sex is simply this. Unlike any other area of our lives, people don't just bounce back from crossing sexual boundaries. You know that, and I know that. That, I mean, like when you think about it, if you've ever been on a date or if you've met someone new, I mean, it's frequent that, you know, people will sometimes joke about their bankruptcy. You know, it's like, oh yeah, you know, I had this bankruptcy 10 years ago, but you know, like move forward, move on, you got over it. People will joke about losing a job. People will joke about, you know, the failing out of college. They'll tell the story about that. People don't tell the story of when they crossed a sexual boundary. People don't joke about that. People don't talk about that on first dates. People don't talk about that even when they're married. People don't talk about this in the same way as they talk about other mistakes. There is more at stake when it comes to our sexual mistakes and our sexual and crossing sexual boundaries. See, here's the other things that I know. There's a shame and a guilt that gets carried around. I mean, when someone crashes their car, they feel like, oh man, I shouldn't have done that. If someone was maybe texting and driving, or someone was a little bit inebriated and driving and they crashed their car into a guardrail, they go, oh my gosh, I'm ashamed of what I did. But 3 years later, they're not carrying around that same guilt and shame. They've actually moved on. When we cross sexual boundaries, 3 years later, we haven't moved on. There's something that's a little different there. Marriages that experience one or both partner having an affair, there's a pain that's hard for people to describe, and it's just as hard to escape. When people talk to me and when I counsel couples who have had affairs, they say there's just this hurt, and I don't know how to move forward. I don't know if I can move forward. I don't know if we can move forward. I still believe in them, but I don't know if I can get over this hurt. I don't know if I can get over that pain. When couples move too fast towards sex in a dating relationship, it forms an artificial intimacy that makes people feel more secure than they actually are. And then when they move towards marriage because they feel closer than they actually are, and then eventually they get married and sex fades, what they find out is they weren't actually all that close to each other. And they may not even like the person that they're now married to. See, one of the things that I saw so much when I was a youth pastor is, we had this big old youth group and a lot of kids. And with a lot of kids, there's a lot of people from I like Jesus, but I'm not ready to like actually pay attention to what he says for the rest of my life. And so they would start dating and they'd date. And it's like, you know, eventually, because they're high school couples, they break up, right? Because that's what you do when you date in high school, you eventually break up. And so they would break up, and then it's like, we broke up, but now we're back together, but we broke up, but now we're back together, but we broke up, but now we're back together. And sometimes I'd have someone come to me and they'd say, Chris, I don't get it. I don't want to be with this person anymore, but I can't find myself able to leave them. And out of every conversation I ever had like that, I would always ask the question, I'm like, did you guys have sex? And either the person would look up and to the right, which is the universal body language for I'm about to tell a lie, or they would look down and to the left, which is the universal body language for I'm ashamed, but I'm going to tell you the truth. And I would say, look, the reason you're having such a tough time, you know, letting go of this person is because you form some attachments that don't belong there. And the reason you can't let go is because it's hard to let go of attachments like that. You think you're closer than you really are. It happens when we cross boundaries when it comes to sex. Crossing sexual boundaries, some people decide that when they cross certain boundaries, they just decide like, you know what? I'm going to become a liar for life because the pain of telling a lie is better than dealing with the guilt than actually facing the truth. I would rather lie and have to deal with that kind of pain than tell the truth and deal with that kind of pain. I don't want to face it. I don't want to talk about it. I'll go into marriage. I'll never tell my partner. I'll never tell my spouse. I'll never tell my husband. I'll never tell my kids. There's just some things I never want to tell anyone. And so I'd rather lie about it than tell the truth. When you cross certain lines with your behavior sexually, it can leave a permanent and a lasting stain on your reputation. I mean, if you pay attention to the news right now, in the Supreme Court nomination that's taking place right now, I mean, I know some people believe the story, some people don't believe the story. I'm here not here today to talk about believing or not believing the story. But here's what I know. There's an event that may or may not have happened 36 years ago. And when it gets brought up in a Supreme Court nomination, that stain doesn't go away. You know what I'm talking about? There's certain things, when we cross certain boundaries, it just leaves a stain on our reputation. And here's the other thing that I know about all of this. This isn't like a Christian thing. I mean, today we're talking about it in church, but this isn't like a Christian thing. This isn't like, oh, people who grow up in church and hear a whole bunch of youth pastors and children's pastors and pastors like talk about, you know, the Bible's view on sex. They experience guilt and shame and they experience all this stuff, but you know, other people don't. We're more enlightened. This isn't like your parents raised you a certain way and because you rebelled against your parents, you feel that way. This isn't like that thing either. This is just a thing. This is reality. That when we cross certain lines sexually, we don't just bounce back. And because this is reality, we need some guidelines and some guidance on how to do this right. And so today, we're going to take a little bit of a look into the Bible about what God has to say about our sexuality. But I just want to... This is a little bit of a pet peeve of mine. You know, if you guys have pet peeves, I have pet peeves sometimes with the way people will talk about the Bible. And one of the biggest pet peeves that I have is when people say, well, we need to return to biblical values about sexuality, or we need to return to biblical sexuality. And I just got to say, so that we're all clear on it, there are certain things that happen in the Bible that are not ever supposed to be repeated. I mean, anybody ever read the Old Testament? Anybody ever read the Old Testament? Let me give you a few things that happened in the Old Testament when it comes to sex. There's a guy named Solomon who, Solomon called himself the wisest man who ever lived, which is just a baller move, first up. But second of all, Solomon, the wisest man who ever lived, had 700 wives. Anybody really think Solomon's all that wise? I don't even know how you'd possibly make that work. On top of that, he had over 1,000 concubines. He was the king of Israel. He did whatever he wanted to do when it came to sex. And that's not supposed to be repeated by anyone. That's not biblical sexuality. There's another guy. He had two wives who were sisters, because that's not weird. He literally had sister wives, and they wanted to have children. Neither of them could conceive. So these wives had a competition with each other, trying to have a baby first. Neither of them could get pregnant, and so they decided, I know what we'll do. We'll give our husband our slaves as concubines, and they can have children, and we'll call them ours. that guy's name, he had 12 sons through his two wives and their two slave concubines. His name was Jacob. He became a man named Israel, who the nation of Israel is named after. That's biblical sexuality, and it's not supposed to be repeated. Adam and Eve, think about this. Adam and Eve, they were the first two people. They had children. From their kids came the entire population of the earth. I don't like to spend too much time thinking about what that means, but I know it's not supposed to be repeated in today, right? Okay, there was biblical sexuality that happened. We're not supposed to repeat it. And David, the man after God's own heart, he had multiple wives, and then he had an affair that he tried to cover up by having the woman's husband killed. He was the man after God. It happened in the Bible. It's not supposed to be repeated. We need to be a little more careful about what we say when we talk about sexuality. So today, we're not going to talk about biblical sexuality. We're going to talk about the New Testament ethic when it comes to sexuality, when it comes to sex, the New Testament ethic. Because if we're following Jesus, we want to pay attention to what the early followers of Jesus paid attention to when it came to sex. And so Jesus, he was on the earth. Jesus died. He rose from the dead. 500 people saw him. They spread the news all over the world. And because they spread it all over the world, there was these people known as Gentiles. Gentiles are mostly, like, I would guess most of us would be considered Gentiles at some point. If you weren't raised Jewish, you would be considered a Gentile. And so as these people who didn't have the Old Testament standard, didn't have all the old stories, had a very different worldview when it came to sex and what was appropriate, the New Testament church began to say, okay, well, here's what it looks like to follow Jesus. And in Acts chapter 15, this is so interesting to me. Maybe it's not interesting to you. In Acts chapter 15, they sat down and they wrote down a list because there was a bunch of people saying, look, if these guys are going to follow Jesus, they also need to follow all of the Old Testament law. And there was another group said, no, we believe Jesus sets us free. We believe Jesus was the fulfillment of the law. And therefore, these people who haven't even ever had the law in the first place, we're not going to put on them a new yoke of the law. We're going to tell them just the basics of what they need to do. So they wrote a letter and they said, okay, here's what the church has decided. You follow the words and the teaching of Jesus. You avoid sexual immorality and don't eat meat that's been offered to an idol. Now, we don't pay any attention to that third thing today because it doesn't matter today. So all we're left with is follow the teaching of Jesus and avoid sexual immorality. And that was the New Testament ethic when it came to sex. So in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, the Apostle Paul is writing to this church in the city of Corinth, which, by the way, Corinth was a city, a large metropolitan area that was known for its pagan worship. And one of the biggest expressions of their pagan worship was at their temples, they always had male and female prostitutes that you could pay to have sex. And that was viewed as worship of the gods. Some of you are like, I want to move to Corinth. Like, that sounds good. You're like, but that was the city that now Paul is writing to. That's their background. That's what they have experienced. That's their mindset when it comes to sex. And Paul is about to write something incredibly different. So in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 18, he says this, flee from sexual immorality. Flee from sexual immorality. What's the verb there? For those of you guys who like the English language, what's the verb there? Flee. Yeah, flee from sexual immorality. Now, just understand what he's telling people to flee from. Flee means run in the opposite direction. Get the, you know, head to the hills, get out of town, get out of Dodge, go away from this. We need to understand, he's saying, flee from sexual immorality. And to understand sexual immorality, we need to understand what Paul thought of as sexual morality, because immorality is anything outside of what's moral. And for Paul in the New Testament church, sexual morality was husband and wife. And whatever goes on between the two of them, that is up to them, and God has blessed that. That was sexual morality. That was the way the New Testament church believed God had created. That was the best that God had created. That was God's intention. That's what God had planned. And so when he says flee from sexual immorality, he's saying flee from anything that's less than what God intended. Flee from anything that's less than what God has said is best. So flee from anything that's different or outside of the context of husband and wife together forever. It's exclusive, baby. Like, that's what God intended. And Paul says, would you flee from anything less than that? So Paul would say, look, if you're single and you cross some lines, that would be sexual immorality. If you are a husband and you step out on your marriage and you cross lines sexually, that's sexual immorality. If you're a wife and you step out on your marriage and you cross lines sexually, that's sexually immoral. If you have been married and you're now divorced or you're widowed and you step out and you cross the line sexually, that would be sexual immorality. That's what Paul would say. Anything less or anything outside of the context that God created it for, he says is sexual immorality. And Paul says we're supposed to flee from that. We're supposed to flee from that. Now, fleeing is what we want for the people that we care about, right? Like when it comes to that, like fleeing is what we want for the people we care about. If you're a husband, you want your wife to flee from anything outside of you. If you're a wife, you want your husband to flee from anything outside of you. If you have kids, you want your kids to flee and you want them to wait for the best that God has. If you have a little brother or a little sister, you hope they're willing to wait for the best thing that God has. You hope that they'll flee. Unfortunately, when it comes to ourselves, we don't like to flee. We like to flirt, right? We like to flirt with sexual immorality. And if we're honest, we said this the first week, that in many of these areas, culture baits us to the edge, says that guardrails are unnecessary, baits us to the edge, and then mocks us when we fall over the edge. We don't like to flee. We like to flirt with the edge. We like to get as close as we can possibly get and hope that we don't fall over the edge. Let me just give a couple examples of how we flirt with sexual immorality. I'm on a little bit of a Julia Roberts kick right now because I just watched the movie Wonder. I don't know if you've ever saw the movie Wonder. I'm not crying, you are. So Julia Roberts is the mom in the movie Wonder, and I was like, oh yeah, Julia Roberts, she's been in a lot of stuff. I looked up whatever else she's been in, and I remember that she was in the movie Pretty Woman. Anybody remember the movie Pretty Woman? In the movie Pretty Woman, Julia Roberts played a prostitute. And I remember, this is, a long time, almost 30 years ago, Julia Roberts is playing this character, and there was all of this uproar about the things that she was wearing and how revealing they were and how much skin she showed. And I remember thinking, like, wow, 25, 30 years ago, we got in a big old uproar of how much skin Julia Roberts was showing, and that's crazy. And then I started to, I actually looked up some pictures. I'm like, what was she wearing? Because I couldn't remember. And I noticed that there's a lot of similarities between what she was wearing that people were outraged over and what now is commonplace for high school girls and college girls to wear to football games. And when we're like, oh my gosh, that's so cute, that's so cute, that's so cute. 30 years ago, when people watched that movie, they said, oh my gosh, that's so inappropriate, but I guess it's okay because she's a hooker. And here's the thing: if that's what you're wearing and that's what you're dressing, I'm not calling you a hooker, and I'm not saying that you look like a hooker. That's not what I'm saying at all. But what I'm saying is, as a culture, we have made a move. We have made a shift to where we would say we move right up to the edge, right up to the edge, and then we act surprised when something happens. We act surprised when a teenage girl gets pregnant, like, oh my gosh, that 15-year-old got pregnant, like, oh my gosh. She must come from a bad family. It's like, no. It comes because we move right up to the edge and we tell ourselves we don't need any boundaries. And we do that all the time. If you think about what we entertain ourselves with, we entertain ourselves with affairs all the time. If you watch TV, if you watch movies, you entertain yourself with affairs. I do it all the time. That's what's in everything that we watch. It's what's in every movie, or every TV show that we watch. It's affairs. Think of the last time you were watching a movie or watching a TV show, and there was two married people that looked deeply into each other's eyes and said, oh, baby, I love you. Let's go to the bedroom and have sex. When's the last time you saw that in a show? Right. Even thinking about it, we're like, no one wants to watch that. I want the drama of people having affairs. We entertain ourselves with affairs. We entertain ourselves with people crossing boundaries and crossing lines, and then we act like it's weird when we see someone actually cross lines in real life. We've entertained ourselves with it, and then we choose to do it. The other thing that I know is true is this: when we think about the things that we entertain ourselves with, whether it's music, movies, TV shows, it is full of negative male behavior when it comes to sex and sexuality. That's what she said. It's full of negative male behavior. It's full of jokes. It's full of stuff that we go, oh, well, they're just kidding around. We go, well, boys will be boys. It's funny because it's in a movie. And it's funny in a movie, but it's not funny when a young man commits sexual assault. It's funny until it's not. It's funny until a boundary gets crossed. But culture tells us, no, boundaries aren't necessary. They aren't necessary. You don't need that. You don't need that. Oh, you went over the edge. Ooh. See, we don't want to flee. We want to flirt. But Paul, when he's writing to the church in Corinth, he says, look, in a culture that tells you to flirt, please don't flirt. He wants to make sure that they understand something really, really big. So if you'd put up the next slide with the big old letters, and if you'd put up the next slide with the big old letters, Paul says, hey, we don't like to flee, we like to flirt, put up the next one. He wants you to flee from sexual immorality. What does Paul want you to do? See, you didn't do it as long as I did. That's good. So flee from sexual immorality. He says, I want you to flee, 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 baby, flee. Run for the hills when it comes to sexual immorality. And then he goes on in the second half of this verse, and he tells us why we should flee. He says, all other sins a person commits are outside the body, but whoever sins sexually sins against their own body. And a better translation of that last word body would be the word self, that they sin against their own self. Now, this is interesting because many of us would say, like, we'd argue, well, like, no sin is worse than any other sin. And I absolutely agree. No sin is worse than any other sin. But different sins do have different consequences. Does that make sense? No sin is worse, but different sins do have different consequences. And Paul is reminding us that while God doesn't view sexual sin differently, and while God doesn't punish it any differently, there are different consequences when it comes to different actions. And when it comes to sexual sin, Paul would say, there's a different consequence than any other sin. That when you sin sexually, when you cross sexual lines, when you cross sexual boundaries, Paul would say, you're not just hurting someone else. You're actually hurting yourself. This is why what we mentioned earlier that we already know, sexual hurt does more damage than any other hurt. This is why it's ridiculous to think of telling someone who's been sexually abused that they should just get over it. This is why we don't tell rape victims to just move on. When certain lines get crossed, it hurts us. And it's true whether someone else crosses the line and hurts you, and it's true whether or not you cross a line and hurt you. This does damage to us. Then he closes off the passage in verse 19. He says this, do you not know? Because he thought, I don't think they know. He said, do you not know that your bodies are temples of the Holy Spirit who is in you? In other words, that Jesus Christ sent his spirit to live inside of you when you follow him. He said, whom you've received from God. He says, you are not your own. You were bought at a price. Therefore, honor God with your bodies. Therefore, honor God with your bod. And so Paul, in this moment, he zooms in on the Christians. In other words, in verse 18, he's saying, look, I just think this is how God created the world. I think this is how God meant for this whole thing to work. And I think this would be wise for everyone to do. But in verse 19 and 20, he zooms in. He says, look, if you're a Jesus follower, this isn't like a choice thing. This isn't an optional thing. This is Jesus paid for my life and for my body and for my mind and my soul and my heart when he died on the cross. Jesus, he takes us to the cross. He says, look, Jesus paid the price for you. He purchased you. So you don't belong to yourself. If you're following Jesus, if you put your trust in Jesus for the forgiveness of your sins, you've been bought. Someone bought you. Someone took ownership of you. And if you want to know how we, in our culture, in the world that we live in, Paul would say, if you want to know how to reflect that to the world around you, you start by honoring God with your bod. And he says, and you honor God with your bod by honoring him with your sexuality. You honor God with your mind and what you think about. You honor God with your mind and what you fantasize about. You honor God with how you view and treat women. And you honor God with how you view and treat men. That's how we honor God with our bodies and with our sexuality. Now, this is kind of just, I just want to make sure we understand. This is one of those areas where you actually kind of have to make a choice. Because if you don't make a choice, that's a choice. If you decide, you know what, hey, I don't need any guardrails when it comes to sexuality, you have made a choice. To say I'm not going to make a choice is to have made a choice. We actually have to make a choice here. And here's the other thing that I know. I'm about to give some guardrails for a lot of different people. And I know that as I say this, some of you are going to think, man, that's really pushy. That's judgmental. That's getting really up into my business. And I don't want someone getting up into my business like that. Like, I don't want you, Chris, and I don't want God getting up into my business and creating a whole bunch of rules for me to follow. I don't want that. But here's the thing that I know, and I hope we can wrap our minds around, that let's say someday you crossed the line sexually. And let's say someday you're falling off the metaphorical cliff when it comes to your sexuality and what you've done and your behavior. In that moment, as you're falling down the cliff, or when you find yourself at the bottom, at rock bottom, chances are you'll pray. And chances are you'll look up to God and go, God, please help. God, would you do something to help? Like, I didn't see this coming. I wasn't prepared for this. I don't know how to deal with this. I don't know what to do. 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 And in that moment, you will want God all up in your business. And so what I want to say today is maybe, just maybe, God wants to get all up in your business on the front end so that he doesn't have to save you on the back end. Does that make sense? So today I want to talk about a few guardrails when it comes to sex and sexuality. And the first one is I'm going to talk about one that's, I just think, for everyone. We're talking about a few that are specific to married people and a few that are specific to single people. So here's the one that's for everyone. I just think this is, it needs to be said. Your phone does not need to be fully functional. Let me say that again, because I thought that maybe would get some more amens. Your phone does not need to be fully functional. In other words, the way we think about fully functional is like, look, if there's a way to communicate with people, if there's an app that connects me to other people, like, I need that app on my phone, so I need Instagram, so I need Twitter, so I need Snapchat, so I need Kick, is that a thing? So I need, like, I need these things because these are things that connect me with other people. But what I know from doing youth ministry for a long time, from talking to adults for a long time, is that these things can also be gateways that move you in the direction of things that you should not be viewing. I mean, in Instagram, what is it? It's pictures and videos. I wonder if someone might be able to put some pictures and videos on there that shouldn't belong there. Twitter, same thing. I mean, Snapchat, like when Snapchat started happening, I was still a youth pastor, and kids were telling me about the stuff that was on Snapchat, and I was going, oh my gosh, like, you're getting addicted to pornography by this app that's on your phone. And in the middle of that moment, like, I was like, they'd say, like, well, I don't like it that I do. I don't like that I do. I say, well, then delete the app off your phone. Well, I need it to communicate with my friends. Okay, well, then you don't really hate that you're looking at pornography. You're okay with it. Like, it's okay for us to not have every app on our phone. There was never a moment where I heard someone say, man, I communicate with my friends on Snapchat. I also have a problem because I look at porn on Snapchat. There was never a moment after that where I went home to Jalen and said, man, you know what I think I need to do? I think I need to get on Snapchat so I can communicate with my friends. Every time I'd have one of those conversations, I'd go home and say, you don't have Snapchat, do you? And I'm never going to get that. And none of our kids will ever have Snapchat. I mean, let's keep the stuff off of our phone. It is okay for your phone to not be fully functional. It's okay to have certain websites that are blocked. It's okay to have certain things that you cannot access. And so if there's something in your life that is drawing you, if there's an app that's, you know, or something that's drawing you towards things that you have no business involving yourself with, delete it, and delete it forever. Don't delete it and then think in 3 months, well, because I wasn't on Snapchat for the last 3 months, I haven't looked at porn, and now 3 months later, I'm ready to get on, back on Snapchat. You are not. Get it gone and get it gone for good. Is that okay to say? Yeah. Your phone does not need to be fully functional. So that's just for everyone. That's for married people. That's for single people. That's for people. Now let me talk to some married people. If you're a married person in the room, can I hear you say yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, we got some married people in the room today. Here's the first guardrail I would say when it comes to if you're a married person. First guardrail is this: don't travel or eat alone with members of the opposite sex when it can be avoided. It's not when it can be avoided on there. It's actually don't travel or eat alone with members of the opposite sex. Now, I put when it can be avoided because there are times it cannot be avoided. Full disclosure, there have been times where, as a pastor, I have had to meet with someone of the opposite sex, and it's been one-on-one. There's been 3 times in the last 3 years, which averages out to 1 a year, where it's just, like, impossible for Jalen to get off of work because she works a full-time job. It's impossible, or, like, hey, it got rescheduled at the last minute because the other person couldn't, you know, she was going to make it, and then she couldn't because it got rescheduled. So, like there are times where it just absolutely cannot be avoided. But here's a few things that I do whenever it can't be avoided. Whenever it can't be avoided, and it's just me and a woman meeting one-on-one, when it happens, Jalen knows who it is. She knows what we're going to be talking about. She knows a general idea how long I think the meeting is going to last. She knows where we're going to be meeting. And she knows when I get there because I text her when I get to the meeting and I text her when I leave. Now, you might think, oh my gosh, Jalen has got him wrapped tight around her finger. Man, that girl, like, crack the whip. She's got some control on that man. She has never asked me to do any of that. That is not because my wife doesn't trust me. I would say this, my wife trusts me because I decided to do that. She has never wondered, where is Chris? Why? I thought this meeting, like in my own head, this was only gonna be like a 30-minute meeting, but he's been gone for an hour. That is not because I've been worried about the people that I was meeting with. But all the time, people who aren't worried about the other person cross lines. They cross lines. And here's the other thing. I think I'm super good looking, thing that I'm worried about someone jumping me in the middle of Starbucks. I don't think that's going to happen. But here's the other thing I know. There have been a lot uglier pastors than me who have wrecked their life and their ministries with affairs. And I do not intend to be one of those pastors who wrecks his life with life and ministry with an affair. I'm just not going to do it. So I avoid it whenever it's possible. There have been times where I've been doing a wedding and in Alamogordo, there was the church I was on staff at. We had a wedding coordinator and it was a lady. And there was a lot of times we'd be doing weddings in Cloudcroft or in Ruidoso, an hour and 15 minutes away. And it was like, man, it'd be a lot cheaper. And we'd actually be able to keep more of our own money if we just drove together. Never happened. Pay the extra money because it's cheaper than a divorce attorney. So you don't travel or eat alone with members of the opposite sex. You go, hey, this sounds like one of those rules that is meant to keep women from gaining influence, keep women at bay. It's not that. If you know me, 60% of our executive leadership team is women. I count on strong women all the time. This is not about, we want to make sure men are the only people with voices. This is about, I want to make sure I safeguard my own life and my marriage. So you don't travel or eat alone with members of the opposite sex. Second guardrail is simply this. Don't confide in or counsel members of the opposite sex. You think, well, they need compassion. They need wisdom. That's absolutely true. In the moment, if they're going through something in their marriage, if they're going through something in their own life, whether they're a single person or a married person, yes, they probably do need some compassion. And they absolutely probably do need wisdom. They don't need you. There are other places to find compassion. There are other places to find wisdom. This is compassionate for your marriage and for their future. If they end up carrying around baggage because of something that happened when they started confiding in or started getting counsel from you, are you actually compassionate about their future? No. This is compassionate for your marriage and it's compassionate for their future. They can find the compassion they need somewhere else. They can find the wisdom they need somewhere else. You can point them in the right direction, but I'm telling you, most of the affairs that I've ever heard the story of, it started in one of these two places. We were working late. We traveled to this thing offsite because we just didn't. It was smarter to save money to travel together. Or it was like, hey, they started talking about the problems that were happening in their marriage, and then I started talking about the problems that are happening in my marriage. And oh my goodness, it was just like we connected. That this is how affairs begin. So we avoid we avoid falling off the cliff by having the guardrail. I just don't confide in or counsel members of the opposite sex. And then here's number three, and I just feel like this is important to say. Don't use social media to reconnect with old flames. Don't use social media to reconnect with old flames. I've heard in the last 10 years, I've heard at least three stories. And they were all students who were in my youth group whose parents reconnected with their old flame from high school. And in 6 months previous, they had reconnected, and now they ran off from the family. And here's the thing, I don't think that automatically happens every time we reconnect with someone, but here's the thing, if there's a chance it does, let's just avoid it. Here's the thing, if you have to freak out about your spouse grabbing your phone because there may be a message from homecoming queen runner-up class of 96, or former Mr. Stud Muffin who now has a little bit of a beer gut that you've recently reconnected with, you have already crossed a line. And it's time to move back, and it's time to cut the connection. This is safeguarding our marriages when it comes to the areas of sex. Now, when we talk to single people, if you're a single person in the room, can I hear you say, yeah? Here's the only thing I can really think of for you. Could you just gouge your eyes out with a spoon? Now, you might think that's funny, but I actually made a slide for it. So just put up that next slide. Just gouge your eyes out with a spoon. But here's the thing. You might think that's funny, but Jesus said, look, if your right hand causes you to sin, okay, that's a joke one. So let me just tell you a few serious ones because we had to lighten the mood somehow there. Okay, so number one, apply the married people's guidelines in your relationships with married people. Here's the thing. You don't be the person that you don't want your future spouse hanging around. In other words, someday you probably hope or intend to be married maybe 5 years from now, 10 years from now. I don't know when you plan on getting married. It might be, you know, 6 months from now and you haven't met someone, so you're behind schedule. But like, I don't know what your plan is, but chances are you plan on someday being married. And you do not want to currently be the person that you hope your future spouse doesn't like. If you're a young lady and there's a bunch of guys that you work with that, like, you know, they pay a lot of attention to you, and like, oh, every time you come around, they seem to just be in a way better mood. It's like, oh, that's really great. Like, here's the thing, just, you know, like, make up the mind that, like, hey, I'm not going to be the person that travels alone with them. I'm not going to seek counsel, or like, I'm not going to do anything that would put them in a position to compromise their marriage. And I'm also not going to build some attachments and some connections that are inappropriate for me now. So we apply the married guardrails in relationships with married people. Number two is to set a personal curfew. Yeah. Establish a personal curfew. You're like, no, okay. Like, I went to college, I left my parents, like, I got out of my parents' house, and I thought, sweet, no one's ever going to tell me how late I can be out again. Woo! That's true. Nobody else is ever going to tell you when you have to be home again, but you need to tell you that. See, there's a reason every mom says things like, there's nothing good happens after, and you all know that. Yeah, someone said 2 a.m. because you had a good mom. So, you know, like... Cool mom, you know, like, but like, so like there's a reason every mom says things like that. You want to know what the reason is? Because it's true. And since nothing good happens after midnight, or apparently 2 a.m. for some people, or 4 a.m., I mean, hopefully you're not, I mean, if you're at 4 a.m., wow, congratulations on being young. But like, if you're in a dating relationship and there are certain lines that you don't want to cross, the reason nothing good happens after midnight is because after midnight, it's not that people get worse, it's that inhibitions get lowered. The more tired you are, the less inhibition you have. And so you may at 10 o'clock think like, whew, I am not going to make out with my boyfriend. I'm not going to let him put his hand up my shirt. I'm not going to do these things. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to do that. Not going to do that. But at 12 o'clock, when your inhibitions are a little bit lowered, it's like, so here's the thing, instead of trying to fight that battle at 12:15, just establish a personal curfew where you head home. Jalen and I, when we were dating, we dated for about 15 months before we got engaged. We were engaged for 6 months before getting married. And the entire time, we had a curfew. This was my idea. Again, I didn't want to be the youth pastor who started sleeping with his girlfriend and got fired. I didn't want that to happen. So we had a curfew. We had a curfew where, because nothing good happens after midnight, even when you're 27, midnight was the curfew. Actually, 11:59 was the curfew. And there would be times where, like, you know, Jalen would work. She was working at Applebee's at the time. And she would work till, you know, 9:30 or 10 o'clock. And then she'd come over to watch a little bit of TV. And sometimes she would fall asleep on my couch. And it'd get to be 11:59. And I'd go get a cold glass of water and just pour it on her face. And I'd say, you got to go. You got to get. And she'd be like, why are you being so mean? I'm like, I'm protecting our future. Never poured water on her face. Thought about it, but no, like there was some, she'd be like, but can I just stay another 10 minutes? I'm like, no, get away from me, Jezebel. You get out. Get. I'm just saying, like, there's a reason we set the curfew. And there's a reason to uphold it, okay? We establish a personal curfew because nothing good happens after midnight. And guess what? When we got engaged, here's something that we heard from a number of people. When you get engaged, it doesn't become easier to pay attention to boundaries. It becomes more difficult. So instead of saying like, okay, well, now we're engaged, we can hang out till 1, we moved the curfew up. We said like, hey, now it's 11. Like, you just got to get, you got to go. You got to get, you know, like, get your bad self out of here, okay? So it's okay to establish a personal curfew. Number three, it's okay to look extreme in your pursuit of purity. I just want to let you know, it's okay. I mean, I think, like, when you hear me talk about a personal curfew, you may think that sounds extreme. For me, it was not extreme. But it is okay to appear extreme in your personal pursuit of purity. Here's something that, a couple things that happened while Jalen and I were dating. Again, she was working at Applebee's, and oftentimes after work, she would come over to my place, and Jalen just, she had a personal conviction, I'm not going to change at Chris's house. Not going to change at Chris's house. So instead of changing at Chris's house, Jalen would get to her car in the middle of the Applebee's parking lot and change in her, I mean, this is admittedly, I think, way worse, but she would change in her car in the Applebee's parking lot because she didn't want to change at her boyfriend's house. It's okay to look extreme. Another thing that we did, that at one point, this happened about, I think it was almost 8 years ago now, there was this massive snowstorm that came through, and it was massively cold temperatures, like negative 10, negative 15, which never happens. It was in the middle of February. And the place that Jalen was living, their water froze, and my water didn't freeze. So after 3 days of having no water, Jalen said, "Hey, I really need to take a shower. Would it be okay if I came over to your place and take a shower?" And I said, "That'd be okay." And then I started thinking about it. I was like, I should probably leave the house. Not because I'm worried, like not because I can't control myself, but just because of how things appear sometimes, I didn't want it even to appear to be lacking in purity. Yeah. So it's okay to look extreme. It's okay to look extreme. It's okay to make sure there's some big, huge guardrails that you cannot cross. It's okay to appear extreme. And then for some of you, I just want to throw this out there. For some of you, you may need to take a relationship break. If for some of you, it may be that you need to take a year off from dating. And here's why I would say that. If for you, date equals sex, you may need to take a year off from dating because there are some things in your head that have come to mean something that they shouldn't mean. If you're a guy and you think, well, because I paid for dinner, I'm owed this, you may need to take a year off from dating. If you're a serial dater where it's like, hey, I go out with this person, this person, this person, this person, this person, and I really don't care about their feelings anymore. It's just about going on the date. It's just about a conquest. It's probably time that you should take a year off from dating. Not because you're bad, not because you're dirty, rotten, or anything like that, but because God needs some time to rewire some thoughts in your brain. And he can only do that with some time and some distance from the dating scene. So, here's the thing. This is one of those areas. We talked about it the first week. When it comes to these areas of our lives, no one plans to wreck their lives. No one plans to have affairs. No one plans to cross boundaries that they didn't. I mean, there's no 13-year-old girl that's like, man, I can't wait to end up as an 18-year-old with a whole bunch of shame and a whole bunch of stories that I just really don't even want my parents or my best friends to even know about. And that some, like, I can't wait for some stories that I don't want to tell my husband someday. No, nobody sets out to have that happen. Very few of us plan for it not to happen. These guardrails, these extreme things, these big old things that are gonna seem kind of restrictive, gonna seem like it's kind of up in your business, gonna seem like, no one lives like that. These are how we plan not to. These are how we plan not to end up in those places that we don't wanna end up. That's why we need guardrails. And that is also a great place for us to stop this week. So next week, we're gonna talk about time. I hope you guys have a great week. Let's pray.